This is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Folks, this is Ben. You are listening to my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Welcome to episode 100. We've reached the century. We made it to triple digits. Look, it's not such a big deal, I know. Most of you who listen to other podcasts will be aware of that. Mark Maron on WTF is about to hit 1,000. Joe Rogan is well over that number. They'd probably be thinking, oh, you've done 100, how adorable. But, you know, I did want to do something a bit special, or at least a bit different, to mark this small achievement. And I'd like to be able to say, therefore, that my guest this week is William Eggleston or Robert Frank. I'd like to be able to say that, but instead, my guest this week is me. Listen, wait, let's do this first. If you enjoy this podcast, you think it's worth the price of a cup of coffee per episode, then please do sign up for a small recurring monthly subscription, or if you prefer, make a larger occasional donation at bensmithphoto.com/asmallvoice. Do please leave a positive review on iTunes so that others may find out about the podcast. And if you should happen to be in need of a new website because your current website is not up to snuff and you can't face sorting it out, I will happily do the whole darn thing for you using the Squarespace platform for a very competitive rate. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the Charcoal Book Club, the first and only book of the month club dedicated exclusively to photo books. Each month, Charcoal Book Club works with the most respected names in contemporary photography to select a first edition monograph that is a must-have for every collection. Each book arrives signed by the artist along with a note card and print from the guest curator, with free shipping to the US, Canada and the UK. Past curators have included Alex Soth, Mark Steinmetz, Andrea Modica, Todd Heido, Ron Jude and many others. All that, along with members-only pricing in their online bookstore and more, makes the Charcoal Book Club the best and most exciting way to stay up to date with essential work in contemporary photography. March's book, which I'm looking forward to receiving very much, is Mariposas Nocturnus by Emmett Gurin. Nocturnal moths to you and me. I've got a good feeling about this one. Go to thecharcoalbookclub.com for more info on that and to peruse their back catalogue. This episode is also sponsored by Finder.me, that's FINDR.me, which is a two-sided marketplace for imaging professionals, providing clients with direct access to thousands of experienced photographers on a single platform, and in turn introducing photographers to hundreds of potential clients. Finder connects photographers with relevant customers based on location and type of photography services offered. Photographers can sign up quickly and easily and for free for corporate contracts at fixed rates, or they can set their own pricing to attract direct clients. And in stark contrast to some of their larger competitors, I know I always say this, but it is true, they really care, they're committed to transparency in the way that they do business. And Finder is for everyone in the photography business, really, from wedding planners to artists. So if you are a photographer, whatever type of photographer you are, go and open an account, start filling out your profile, and open up a whole new way of finding new work, finding new clients, and finding new opportunities. Join up for free at finder.me and get yourselves found. So anyway, yes, look, I am the guest. I'm not going to read a bio because that would feel weird. I'll write something in the show notes on the website. I know this may seem horribly narcissistic to some of you. Believe me, I get it. I was very uncomfortable and uncertain about doing it. But whatever, I'm not at all a narcissistic person. What I thought was that episode 100 might be a timely opportunity to talk about how and why the podcast happened in the first place, and whatever else my nominated interviewee, the lovely Abby Traylor-Smith, who you can find on episode 12, wanted to ask me, get a chance to feel what it's like for the tables to be turned. So for what it's worth, bombs away, folks. Here's Abby Traylor-Smith being me, and me being the guest on episode 100 of A Small Voice. Does that all sound good?
Yeah, it sounds really good. I feel okay. Like I'm listening to the podcast. I love it.
Yeah, that's kind of it. Just be close to that. Okay. Oh my gosh. You remember that time a while ago? I think it was the first Photo London I did, and I was at Offprint, the book fair in Tate Modern, and I was in a room talking into my microphone on my own podcast, looking at my own pictures, and I said, that's the most narcissistic thing I've ever done in my life. I think I'm about to top that.
Yeah, but it's nice to find out the man behind the show.
Well, I don't know. I think
have we started? Why am I asking you?
Of course we have. I think it's quite useful for me to experience this. That was my thinking when I thought that it might be good to do this for the 100th. But then actually, in the last couple of weeks, I've done a couple. I did Out of Focus with Ian and Bradley, and I did 10 frames per second. So since I decided that it would be interesting for me to experience what it's like to be on the other side of the microphone, I have done that. But, you know, but we were already committed to doing this then, so...
Yeah, so... Great. Well, it's very exciting to be on this side.
Thank you so much.
I don't know which one of us feels more nervous. I mean, I've listened to every single podcast you've done.
Have you really? That's amazing. Thank you.
And they have been amazing.
Let me just say why I thought you would be the right person to do it. Because of that, because I know that you listen. And just because I think you got it from the start. And it always kind of struck me that you were my kind of avatar, in a way, my kind of imaginary ideal listener. Like, you're a pro photographer, you get what the podcast is about, you like it. Not that you have to be a pro photographer, loads of my listeners are either students, you know, wannabe photographers, or even people who are just interested in photography, have no interest whatsoever in trying to do it for a living or anything. But just because you were always very supportive of it, really supportive of it, and I really always appreciated that, so thank you.
Yeah, well, I think for me I didn't go to university or anything to study photography, and for me it's like an education, and I'm
that's great to know,
you know, not just kind of, it's not just fun to listen to and interesting, it for me it's been a real education. So I want to start asking you, because what I've noticed from all your people who've appeared on the podcast is everyone's got one thing in common, and probably all the listeners as well, is that everybody loves photography. So when did you first fall in love with photography?
Quite young. There was a couple of phases to it for me. I was about 10 or 11, and I kind of got into it. I think it was because my dad was into it. He was an amateur photographer. He was quite a keen amateur photographer. And I think, you know, when you're that age, you kind of might gravitate towards the things that your dad does, maybe especially when you're a boy. So I kind of got into it probably because he was into it. And I remember my mum bought me a little camera. Ironically, it was my mum who bought it, not my dad, because that pretty much tells you everything you need to know about my parents, or about my father anyway. She actually was the one who took me to buy a little camera, shit little camera. And then eventually, after my dad, you know, made it clear that was completely a shit camera to buy, and it was just like, well, you know, I wonder who should have been the one to buy the camera. But anyway, then I ended up with he did end up getting me an SLR eventually. But I was keen at that stage, and then when I was like going to secondary school, so it would have been 11, we moved house, and a couple of my neighbours who were like a year or two older than me, who ended up being, you know, my closest buddies, they were into photography as well, and it was just a massive coincidence completely that you know, I had these two friends who were roughly the same age who were also keen, and we all kind of got into it together, really. And so at that sort of stage, through to my sort of mid-teens, I was keen, and I didn't know what to photograph, you know.
I was just going to say, what were you...
I had no idea what to photograph. It was that whole horrible process of knowing that I was interested in a thing that I didn't know what to do about, like, because they're a bit older than me, they're a bit like too cool for school, and I was like, I mean, I used to like hound them. I used to say, can we process some film, please, can we process some film, I've got my process, you know, just to bug them constantly to help me process film and all this stuff. And it was just like pulling teeth half the time, you know. And so I used to sort of wander about trying to think, well, what would be something to photograph, and of course, like, you know, what I should have photographed for my friends, and you know, I did photograph my friends to some extent, but at the early stages, I didn't really know. I got into the darkroom, as a lot of us do, and in my mate Smudge's parents' futility room, as we used to call it, because of the amount of, you know, misery that was involved in wasting paper and printing things badly. But
so was it black and white you started
black
out
and
with?
White, very much black and white.
And where were you living at this point?
Hemel Hempstead.
Okay.
The kind of provincial backwater hellhole kind of childhood.
then I kind of moved away from it, really. My interest was in, you know, like I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be a newspaper guy. I came from a long line of newspaper guys. There's a lot of journalism in my family, and not that that's necessarily why, but I was absolutely 100% set on being a journalist, and photography was just a hobby. Weirdly, it didn't occur to me that there could be some way of bringing those two things together, you know. It's just that was just not on the agenda at all. But I wanted to do a very kind of traditional newspaper apprenticeship, do the training and all that stuff, and be a writer.
This is when you were like sort of 15, 16.
Yeah, 13, 14, 15. But then I kind of failed to appreciate the fact that I was destroying everything and throwing it all away at that stage. And
destroying what?
My future, my life, everything. I just, you know, I kind of failed all my exams and just let it all go to hell, really. And then I had to kind of claw myself back. But the photography went away. I did ultimately claw myself back and go and get a degree, which was in basically video and radio production, essentially. It was a media production degree. And then I sort of shifted my focus toward documentary film, really, you know, and that was what I kind of majored in as much as one does major in anything in this country, and came out of there wanting to get a job in television at the bottom rung of the ladder and try and get into making documentaries. But kind of while I was trying to do that, I went and worked for a local newspaper, and, you know, which was staffed almost entirely by a couple of kind of supervising adults and a bunch of kids. Us, mind you, I was 20-something, but I was a kid. I was still a kid at that stage. I mean, I was a kid, probably a kid until relatively recently, to think of it. But it kind of, my old interest in writing and journalism was reignited, really. And I realised I always knew I could do it. I always knew I had an aptitude for it, and it turned out I did. And I didn't ever really want to do sort of hardcore news reporting like most people do. I was a bit more into feature writing and that kind of thing. But I ended up... The newspaper went down the pan, which is why it was staffed by a bunch of children, because they didn't have to pay anyone proper salary. And you know, there were some good pros there, you know, sort of, as I say, in charge of the ship, but it went down the pan. And I moved to London with my girlfriend, and I started, like, I went on the Enterprise Allowance Scheme, which was one of Thatcher's initiatives, which basically meant you could sign on and do some training, and you could sign on and work at the same time, essentially, is what it kind of came down to.
So you sort of fell in love with photography as a kid, and then went off and did your degree in documentary, and then ended up on the local paper, and then moved to London. At that point, you hadn't come back to photography.
Exactly. And it was doing this, like, I started freelancing, writing stuff on spec and sending it into magazines and stuff. I didn't realise that that was just insane and that you can't really do that. You know, sometimes it really helps to be stupid and ignorant about the reality of the situation, because if you don't know that you're not supposed to be able to do that, then you just kind of do it anyway. And, you know, and I was a reasonable writer, and I used to sell copy to people, and then they'd say, have you got any pictures to go with this feature? And I'd be like, yes, actually I have. And then I'd be like, fuck, I've got to go and take some pictures. And because I knew that I could, you know, I still had the kind of basic sense memory of being able to shoot with an SLR, I knew roughly what I was doing. I just kind of threw myself into it. It was just the same as the writing, really. I just thought, well, screw it, I'll do it. There's no one else can do it. It's either me or no one. And if there's more chance of selling the feature, if I got some pictures, I'll just go and do some. And then I started taking pictures again. Until that time, I mean, from the period where I kind of lost interest in the whole black and white thing through to then, I was taking pictures of my buddies getting pissed in the pub like everyone does, but not in any kind of serious sense. But that kind of got me back into the black and white and all that. And then at exactly that time, I remember, for whatever reason, I discovered the World Press Award exhibition every year at the Barbican here in London. And I used to go to it, and I was completely smitten, totally in love, smitten, blown away. And I, probably a couple of years on the trot, and after like maybe the second year, I was like, I think I just would like to do this if I can. You know, I'd like to, maybe I could do this. And I remember, you know, certain stories, like, oh, why do I always forget this guy's name? He has this little special little place in my... what I'm going to laughingly refer to as my trajectory here, Abby. Right. Andrew Tester.
Right.
Yes.
great photographer.
He did a story in the World Press, or made it into the World Press. I think he got a third prize for it. And it was about hunt sabs.
Right.
And what struck me about it was it wasn't shot halfway across the world somewhere. It was shot here in the UK, and it was the sort of thing that, you know, people when I was at college used to go and do at the weekends. And I guess the significance of it was that I realised that if you want to do that job, you don't have to be going off to, you know, some exotic location. This was a really, you know, solid little piece of reportage that was done here. And I thought, yeah, fuck, maybe I could do that. And anyway, to cut a really boring story short, I signed up immediately for the London College of Printing photojournalism, a 1 year postgrad course, which is, you know, as you know, still going, but in a different guise. It's now an MA, but in those days it was a 1 year postgrad, and that, you know, was a weird kind of course in a way, because they were trying to teach writing as well, you know, and photography, as if photojournalism meant doing both, which is a kind of absurd notion, really. I don't think.
But
anyone...
that's what you had been doing both, hadn't you?
Well, the appeal for me was that I knew that I was already doing the writing, so yeah, in that sense, it helped me get in, I suppose, because I didn't have much in the way of photography to show people, and also I knew that I had that down to a point beyond anything they were really, you know, teaching to, because they were trying to essentially teach people from scratch in 1 year those two different, you know, it's absurd in a way. So I knew I could focus on the photography and not worry about the writing, because I was already doing that,
you know. I love that ding moment where you see a piece of work and you think, oh, and it kind of resonates with you and you think, I could do that.
Yeah.
So what were your projects at the LCP?
Oh man, my final project, I went to the TT, the Isle of Man.
Right,
The TT races is like infamous motorbike road race, which has been, you know, this is a very sort of famous event in that world, which is a world my brother was sort of into. So I did that, partly because I was crap at coming up with ideas for things. That's always been, or was at that stage, a bit of a kind of barrier in a way, because it was fine, you know, but what can you do in over the course of what, 3-4 days, you know? If I'd had any sense, I would have found a project in London that I would, you know, would have been working on prior to that for some time. But, you know, whatever, that's what I did, and I shot a few other little bits and pieces, but that was the final thing. And of course, that you could sort of choose to do, you could weight it towards the photography or the writing. Okay. Depending on how you were feeling. Obviously, most people were into the photography, but I knew I could already do the writing, so I just, you know, I wrote some copy to go with it, obviously.
I've got to say, I don't think you necessarily need to choose a project that you'd spend years doing. Sometimes it's fun to go and do something that's a week long. Mm. So were you proud of that piece of work
at that time? No, not at all. It was adequate. I mean, okay. I passed the course. I mean, I'm not really ever proud of anything. I mean, there's always, you know, too many things wrong, but it was okay for what it was. And it was a nightmare. I mean, logistically, the whole thing was just a total train wreck. I mean, I don't know.
That's
what
right,
I do not
think
know.
Think positively.
Yeah, I just don't know what came over me. I don't know what I was thinking. And I did a thing, like I did this thing. Wow, I did this other story. Someone who, like, my mum knew this bloke who was into flying. And he was in this group of amateur, almost like display pilots, and they all flew the same plane. So they're all kind of basically very successful, very wealthy guys who, you know, in their own right had got into flying, and they'd all got into this particular plane. This is a thing called a Yak, which is a Russian plane. Now we're getting into some really kind of, this is all photographic related. And I sort of, you know, I was like, that would make an amazingly great story. So I went off to a story about them, and you know, it's that thing that when you're young, people would just let you do shit, invite you into stuff, you know, like no one tells you to fuck off. It's just like, yeah, come and do it. And it's like you know you've got this kind of naivety to it, but also people, I don't know, just seem to respond to your kind of youthful optimism, or youthful enthusiasm.
I was going to say, I think it's the enthusiasm. When people see that you're interested in something, they let you in. Right. I don't think it's got anything to do with being young.
And these guys were very sort of, I mean, they were in, you know, obviously these guys were in their own way very smart operators. You know, you don't get to that position, you know, where you get to, you know, fly your own plane But they didn't know anything about that world particularly. I mean, you know, they could have got some good publicity one way or another. But I did a story about them and they took me up and all that. And I shot it on Tranny. Why did I shoot it on Tranny? I have no idea why I shot it on Tranny, but I shot it on Tranny. Obviously, it was something that I thought should be done in colour. And that was another one of the things I did at college. And then I tried to flog it. And I remember going to see Loaded magazine, which the youngsters won't even remember. But I went to see Loaded magazine and they were like, well, it's a bit too good for us, really. You know what I mean? This is a bit too kind of slick, you know. And I was like, but it's very encouraging when you have those experiences, because you realize actually there's no reason why you can't be one of the people who does that stuff for a living in the way that you fantasize about doing it, as long as you've got a little bit of self-belief, which I didn't have at all, any of. So, you know.
But isn't it interesting that so many photographers don't seem to have as much self-belief as we would think they would, and yet yeah. There's something that just keeps propelling you forward, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, well, or fake it, if you know, fake it till you make it kind of thing. I mean, either you need to have the self-belief or you need to have the capacity to fake it. And those two things are essentially the same thing, I think, you know, because it's really just as useful to be able to let other people think you've got that. And, you know, I sent this thing off, like some slides and some copy. I sent it off to like people like GQ. And, like, I got a phone call from GQ.
I mean, that would have been so exciting.
And, yeah, like, this guy Grubb Smith called me up, who, again, you know, people from that world might remember. He was, like, a really, you know, like, proper, experienced, old-school kind of writer, commissioning editor, whatever. And, you know, it's all no mobile phones. Like, guy phones me up, and he's like, yeah, it's Grubb Smith here, it's GQ. And I was like, fuck, freaking out, thinking, oh, my gosh. And he was like, look, you know, I really like that airplane thing, that thing with the guys, but you know, and we can't run it for XYZ reason, but what else you got, you know, what else? And like, I couldn't believe that kind of thing could happen, really. And I didn't have any faith in my writing or my photography, so you know, you get these little signs, don't you? You get these little signs from the muse, who, you know, who's saying, look, listen, I'm going to throw you a bone here, like, you know, just fucking actually take it on board, okay? Don't think that GQ are, you know, are phoning you up for a laugh, you know. They're putting the phone down and going, ah, we wound that guy, you know. But
and was that while you were still at college, or was that?
Yeah, because he said, what are you doing? I said, oh, actually, I'm going to the TC. I'm going to do a piece about the TC. Do you want that, you know? So, you know, I was kind of in there already. And as I say, I'd already had a little bit of experience prior to that with this writing thing, because I was selling features. So I kind of knew that it was possible. You know, like I could sell a piece to The Independent about my buddy making little Super 8 movies, you know, and I'd take a picture of him and, you
Sounds
know, so.
Like you kind of fell into it quite swiftly.
Yes, quite quickly I did, but it's just as easy to fall out of it just as quickly. That's the trouble.
Well, let's not rush ahead to that bit. No. So talk us through
ahead that far, to be honest.
Let's talk us through that kind of, you know, you got your, what was it, a degree?
Postgrad diploma, yeah.
Yeah, so you got that, and then you'd had all these exciting phone calls and,
yeah,
you know, yeses, and then what?
Well, I guess, I mean, I suppose the main thing was that I decided to focus on the photography, and I bitterly regret that. That was a horrible decision, but for whatever reason.
What?
No, I mean, I should have kept writing. There's no question about it. And, you know, I think to some extent I bought into the idea that you're not allowed to be good at more than one thing. You know, there was this sort of overriding sense that I think was, you know, gets put about by the people who aren't good at more than one thing. You know, they're the people who don't. And it's a bit like you're getting a bit above your station if you can be. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's hard to articulate.
Well, I think it's a different world now, isn't it? Like now you're expected to do
exactly.
very much more than one
now
thing.
It's more
but
like,
when
yeah.
I started out, it was very much like you were either a writer or a photographer
right.
or a filmmaker
yeah.
or whatever.
And there are all these people who are a bit like, you know, oh, stay in your lane, you know. Like, well, fuck you in your lane. You know, if you look at someone like Stephen Fry, you know, like a genuine polymath, you know,
yeah.
someone who can do 6 or 7 things ridiculously well, and then it starts to feel like doing 2 things well is no big deal. But I for whatever reason thought that I needed to sort of drop the writing, or maybe it just happened organically, but I focused on the photography from there on, really. And you start working for little magazines. There were certain little magazines that, you know, had a kind of tradition, or even a sort of a kind of stated, you know, mission in a way to give people a start, you know, like nursing times and all these little magazines.
Did you have a kind of, you know, like a key magazine that you were like, that was the dream to work for them? Or was it just about getting regular work? And
without doubt, what I wanted to do was sell my own photo stories to the independent magazine, you know, because that had at the time, again, you know, people of a certain generation will remember, and loads of the people who I've spoken to on the podcast were the guys who used to work on that publication a lot, and you know, Cal Lethigra, and loads of guys, Ed Sykes, loads of people. I would have wanted to be that guy, you know, be freelancing and just out there hustling and selling stuff on spec, you know, or shooting stuff on spec and then selling it to the indie or the, you know, Sunday Times magazine and all those kind of people. That would have been my goal.
So what did you do?
I got an amazing break in that I went to Perpignan a few years, which was the thing to do in those days, and I loved it to bits. I was so in love with all that, you know, the kind of photojournalism thing. And the screenings, you know, the kind of evening screenings. I know everyone's become really cynical about all that shit now.
I haven't. I think those places are great. Yeah. I mean, not just Perpignan, well, but Perpignan, there's a lot of festivals now. And it's a chance to sort of meet other people who are completely obsessed and crazy about photography like you.
And in those days, I just had that kind of naive enthusiasm for it. You know, I hadn't got jaded. And, you know, cynicism is such a... You know, it's a virus, you know, it infects everyone and everything, and it no good can come of it.
You've got to stay away from it.
I know, as someone who's fucking been there and bought the T-shirt, I know it's not a thing to do. So I learned that at some point, I don't know when, but I went to Perpignan and I met someone from the Sunday Times. Candice, her name was, and she was a very experienced picture editor on the style section, which, as you know, is kind of, you know, fashion and fluff and just the absolute opposite of what I was interested in. But got chatting with Candice, and she was very lovely, and I don't know why she used to go to Perpignan, because she was interested in photography, you know, beyond just what she was commissioning, or she liked the jolly, you know, because it was a nice thing to do or whatever. But I remember chatting with Candice, she was really sweet, and she said, come and see me when you get back to London. And I said, all right, I bloody will.
Yeah.
And then she was like, you know, okay, well, make sure you do, you know. And you know, I'm stupid, but I'm not bloody stupid. You know, I knew that was going to be something I had to do. So I went into the style section with a portfolio full of black and white reportage. And I was like, this is such a mismatch. It's hilarious, you know. And, you know, that she looked at it, and she sent a couple of her deputies to look at it. And they just started giving me jobs straight away. And, you know, and that was it. And I worked for Sunday Times, you know, week in, week out for years after that.
Brilliant.
And that was my intro. So it was quite a, and of course I didn't really appreciate, and this is a great regret as well, but you know, I didn't really appreciate how lucky I was in a way. I didn't make the most of the opportunities, and of course when you're working for a paper like that, you get other opportunities because you meet all kinds of incredible people, and you know, you've got the kudos of that publication behind you in a way, you know, which is brilliant. You know, you don't have to do too much because they already think that you must be good or cool, you know, perhaps not cool, or even good, but you know.
No, you're in. You've got the in.
Yeah, I got the in. Know. So, I did a lot of portraits for them, and actually, really, what happened was I ended up working mainly for the travel section, not doing travel pieces, but doing portraits of. They used to do various features. They used to do a feature called My Holes on the back of the travel section, which was some kind of celeb. Talking about their holes, you know, it was like a 1,000-word piece of fluff, and that needed a portrait. So that was kind of my gig, you know, and it was amazing because it was kind of an apprenticeship. But you know, apprenticeships are normally, you know, they normally take place, you know, under kind of fairly low risk, you know, situations. But suddenly you're working for a prestigious major, you know, incredibly high circulation.
Well, they're the best newspaper. Kind of apprenticeships.
Yeah,
I had
exactly.
A similar thing, so.
And I used to just, you know, oh man. I mean, there's so many things that I just rock up with my little Mamiya 6, you know, because it was a square picture. It was always a square picture, so I thought, well, I better get a square camera then, you know. So I bought a Mamiya 6. And, you know, I used to rock up to these hotels and stuff, you know, with like no lights and, you know, some 800 ASA film and just wing it, really, you know. But, you know, not to be kind of nostalgic about it because I loathe nostalgia, as everyone should now know, because it keeps coming up in the last few interviews. But it was good times, you know, and I didn't really appreciate it, to be honest, because it was always that, oh yeah, but I don't really want to be doing this. I want to be, you know, James Nachtway or whoever. And, you know, I did a couple of things, and because obviously I had an in, I ended up doing a couple of things for the magazine as well. But I didn't ever really consolidate the advantages that I was being handed. And, you know, you've got to do that, kids. You've got to do that, kids. You've got to do that. Otherwise, you know, it will slip away. It will slip out of your grasp. And you know, it's hard to get back there.
I was going to ask, you know...
Don't forget to drink your tea.
Yeah, I'll have a little gulp in a sec. Mm. What do you regret then? Like, it sounds like you were just living
about everything.
Yes, it sounds like you were living the life. You were doing the jobs and you were enjoying it. So, looking back, what would you have done differently?
You know what I would have done differently? I would have used every opportunity to get better. I would have used every opportunity to experiment, to learn how to light, to just be a better portrait photographer, rather than falling back on the kind of little box of tricks I already had. That's what I would have done, I think.
Okay, well, that's good advice to everyone out there.
And I would have tried to make more, you know, contacts in other publications, because I think one does get kind of, you know, it's almost like there's an unspoken rule that if you work for one paper, you don't really work for the other.
Yeah,
and I see why that. There is a certain sense to that, because there's only so much work to go around. But I could have just, like, for instance, okay, I'll give you an example. So I did a picture for the Review. I used to do stuff for the Review as well. My gigs were like doing the My Holes portrait and doing the exhibition openings and that kind of thing for the Review, which was fun. You know, you go to an exhibition opening, it's the preview day, or it's the day before, it's the press day, you know, and you have to kind of grab some PR girl from the, you know, from the museum or whatever, and put her in the frame, and, you know, it's fun, it's lovely, you can really enjoy yourself. So I used to do a lot of that, and I did a picture which, you know, I still have on my website, of an opening, and the guy who used to edit the style section, Jeremy Langmead, had moved on to edit GQ or something.
Okay.
And he phoned the picture desk to say how much he liked the picture. He fucking bothered to pick up the phone, you know, from his office in, you know, GQ Towers and tell them how much he liked it. Now, did I phone Jeremy and say, "Hi, Jeremy, it's Ben. I heard you like that picture. I just want to say, you know, how lovely that is, and thanks so much. And, you know,
get a job.
And I've always loved GQ, you know, or whatever. Did I do that? No, I fucking did not do that.
It was different then, though. You, like you say, you were kind of, whoever you did your regular work for, then you were kind of their man, weren't you? Whereas now it's kind of, you can work for anyone and everyone.
Mm. Well, I think it's a genre thing as well. Like, I think if you're with a Sunday paper, if you're with the Sunday Times, you're probably not going to sidestep into the Observer and vice versa. But you could certainly go from a Sunday newspaper to a monthly glossy mag, you know, because those are two, they're not in the same market, basically. And I could have done that. But there are, like, you know, that's just one example of like a gazillion examples of times when, for whatever reason, because I didn't have the confidence, or I didn't have the belief in myself, or, you know, or I have this unbelievable capacity for self-sabotage, which is so expert. I should have a PhD in self-sabotage.
Listeners can't see me smiling right now.
Yeah. Well, that might ring a bell.
Don't you think that kind of, you know, failure is a sort of step on the way to success?
I do feel that very, very much so. I mean, you know, failure is, you know, the foundation of growth, and without failure you can't succeed. You know, it's a given. You have to go through that, but it's a question of how you respond to it. You know, if you respond to it by not really doing anything,
it's got to galvanize you.
Yeah, it's got to galvanize you, and you've got to have the capacity to crack on, really. And I think if you have that, then you'll be right. I didn't have that in those days.
So what?
I think I was basically sleepwalking through my life.
And how long, when did you wake up then?
I don't even know if I have yet, Abby. Maybe when I started this podcast, you know, I mean, it was three and a half years ago, but that was kind of a wake-up call to myself, I suppose, to some extent. Yeah, I mean, to some extent, it's helped me to at least start to realise, you know, where I could make some changes to my attitude.
Well, I mean, I've certainly learned a lot from all the people you've chatted to, so you presumably have.
And I have, massive amounts. It's amazing.
What made you start the podcast in the first place?
I think it was a last-ditch attempt to drag myself out of the mire, really. I think it was like, you know, a shot of redemption, you know. I think that...
Because you obviously still, you know, I think when once you fall in love with photography, it's a lifelong thing, isn't it? So you obviously had that.
Yeah, I sort of still had that. And I kind of fell in love with podcasting as a medium, because once I kind of discovered it and got into it, immediately it was appealing. And you know, I got the sort of intimacy of it and I loved it. You know, WTF Mark Maron probably was my first intro into it. The first time I heard that guy's voice on the podcast through my headphones, I was like, oh, wow, yeah, this is something. This is great. And then, you know, it took me about 6 months to suddenly go, oh, photography. Why don't I see if there's any photography podcasts, because I'm a bit slow on the uptake. And I guess I was sort of surprised not to find the podcast that I was hoping to find. There were a couple. I mean, obviously, I always going to mention Candy Frame, Ibarinex Pirello, who, you know, has been doing it like longer than anyone, as long as there have been podcasts. And you know, kudos to Ibarinex for that. But obviously, you know, he's based in the States. And I thought, wow, maybe I ought to do this. Maybe actually I've got the skill set to do this. Maybe, or at least I won't suck at it, you know, like, because I had these rusty old radio skills and a journalistic instinct, really, you know, a kind of love of stories and people talking about themselves. And so, I don't know, I can't really remember, but I just thought, I'm going to go for it. I mean, I remember, I've still got the emails. I remember sending Vanessa Winship an email saying, listen, I've got this mad idea. I'm going to start a photography podcast. If you and George would talk with me. I have no idea what it's going to be like, but I'd love it if you do it, you know. And they said, yeah, of course, we, you know, of course.
Because you were at college with...
Vanessa, yeah. She did the same course as... She did the same course as me at London College of Printing, the same photography course. That's where we met on that. And we happened to be relative neighbours. We both lived in the same part of town at that stage. So I got to know her through that, and then obviously George through knowing Ness. So, you know, I just went for it, really. And I wanted to, you know, make the podcast that I kind of wanted to listen to. And also, there were all these other things, like I genuinely want to sort of make up for some of those aforementioned kind of tendencies, really. And I thought, well, maybe my photography career is, you know, a dead duck, you know, it's too late. But if I apply those lessons that I've learned, those kind of hard-won lessons that I've learned in recent years about all the things that I didn't do right, you know, persistence and, you know, just doing it and not fearing failure and, you know, all those things that we all have to learn and hopefully learn a lot sooner than I did. If I apply those things to this podcasting business, then I can see whether that will make a difference to whether it, you know, whether it's successful or not, because I was pretty sure that those were the keys, you know, having not done those things and having paid the consequences of not doing those things.
I mean, I think we've all done them, and that's what I've really got from listening to your podcast, is that what makes someone successful, I mean, obviously there's a bar at which you've got to kind of take some good pictures, but beyond that, it's really like, how much do you want it? How much do you want to make it happen? And the people that really want to make it happen get there in the end.
Yeah. But you have to have, in order to get to that point, some level of self-belief that why can't you be the one, you know, to do it in the same way that, you know, anyone else might be, rather than that voice in your head that is constantly trying to remind you how much you suck.
You've just got to learn to
to tell that voice to shut the fuck up. Yeah, and that's what I ultimately did. And I think it is true that, you know, if you listen to that voice, you're screwed. And I, you know, I've had that voice my whole life. Dad, I like to call it. but that's another story. You know, part of me was turning into, actually, you know, my father, really. You know, he was someone who, you know, hadn't made it and was just turned into a sort of kind of pissed off, broken-hearted, you know, misanthropic kind of person. And I was thinking, like, fuck, I could easily have turned into that person. And I thought...
Is your dad alive?
No, he's dead now.
I was going to say.
Yeah, he's not listening. My mum will be listening. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, he was a very complicated person, but he, you know, there's this guy called Brian Koppelman, whose podcast I listen to. He's a screenwriter, basically, and he's got a podcast called The Moment. And you know, he's got this whole theory that, you know, if you're a creative person, or if you, you know, identify as a creative person, because I think everyone is, but if it's part of your own sort of self-identity that you're a creative person, you know, if your creativity is not being expressed, if you're, for whatever reason, not making the stuff that you think, you know, in your heart you ought to be making, or doing the stuff you know in your heart you ought to be doing, you become toxic, basically. You know,
yeah, because...
The kind of misery of that situation kind of leaches into you, and that toxicity will then spread to the people around you.
I mean, you spoke earlier about your kind of cynicism and how that was a kind of rabbit hole you went down. It sounds like you were busy running down that rabbit hole of cynicism and upset when you decided to do the podcast, and it's kind of...
Yeah. Well, I think cynicism is the kind of result of, you know, unhappiness, really, you know, and anger, you know, at your own situation. You know, they say depression is anger turned inward. I think there's a lot to that. But I didn't want to end up being that guy, because I know what that looks like, and it ain't fucking pretty, you know. I saw that in my dad, and I thought, I don't want to be that guy, you know. And I thought, if I do this podcast, it's going to make me get out there and meet other people who are successful, who are doing the thing that I'm kind of angry with myself for not doing. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to celebrate their achievements. I'm going to be endlessly gracious and positive, and I'm going to be all the things that I'm really in danger of not being, because that's part of who I am as well. You know, it's just that we've all got different sides to us, and I'm never going to let that shit come up anymore. You know, that sort of, you know, like that fuck, you know, like I just
so
hate
that
people,
so that was an, you know, absolute decision. You were like, right, I'm that, kinda, that was your turning point.
You know what I've got I'm going to play this. Okay, I remembered. At the time, I made these like little voice memos to myself on this phone.
Right.
Those phone voice memos. Shall I play it?
Go on then.
It will be sweary. I'm warning everyone. but listen to this. I recorded two, right? I'll play them both, because this might be quite interesting. So this was September 2015.
Just a note about what this podcast thing's about. Just occurred to me, you know, it's really going to be really quite difficult even to get people to go to iTunes and rate and review it. You know, not everyone even has iTunes. Certainly people don't know what a fucking podcast is, let alone how to subscribe to one. So it just got me thinking that, you know, the reason for this thing is that it's an exercise in learning some of the lessons that I still need to learn, that I haven't applied to my photography or anything else up to now. I'm starting from scratch with a new undertaking that I can apply some of these lessons to. Lessons about persevering, about continuing through obstacles, you know, the stoicism thing of turning those obstacles into advantages, of just doing it without questioning too much, of facing up to resistance and of overcoming it and of turning pro, in Stephen Pressfield's terms. It's about all those things. And, you know, yes, they are things I should have figured out by now at 50, but I haven't, because I haven't had the tools really. So now is the chance. So the point is, it doesn't fucking matter if I can't get arrested on Facebook. It doesn't matter if, you know, people don't sign up to the podcast or listen to it. The only thing that matters is continuing to do it and doing it as well as I can do it for as long as I can do it, and seeing what comes of it, and not really paying too much attention to, you know, each kind of incremental outcome. It's just, you've got to just keep going and try and get better at it and have integrity and be fucking honest about everything in the only way that I know how. And those are the things that it's for. You know, it's not about whether it fucking succeeds or fails. It's about, you know, failing well if necessary. And it's, you know, about the old feel the fear and do it anyway, you know? It's about that. It's about if your nerve deny you, go above your nerve. And that's the big one as well. So, yeah, it's all those things.
That is brilliant. There that's fucking genius.
That's
I love it.
Isn't
that
it?
Is so interesting.
So,
oh my god, what was going? What else was going on for you at that point? I mean,
18th of September 2015.
We, you know, had you had therapy? It's kind of that sounds.
I've had
like...
tons of therapy, yeah, but that's. I mean, I was probably quite depressed. I mean, I have been depressed forever since I was a fucking kid. Interestingly, you know, I haven't been for some years now. Since I did this podcast thing. No, I mean, you didn't know me in those days. That I was just, that's what I was like. That's just my default kind of...
But you've kind of hit every nail on the head there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that was just probably me doing a kind of brain dump onto this thing. Right, so you want to hear the second one?
Yeah, go
for it. Let's hear the second one. This is about a week later.
Man. Depressed. Fucking hell. Sun just came out though, so fucking hell. Makes a little bit of difference. You know, the other thing about the podcast I have to remember is that it's kind of a jumping off point for getting back to the Tower Hamlets project. Because I'm not actually fucking taking pictures and I'm not a photographer. And if I'm not a photographer, I don't want to do the fucking podcast. I don't want to be a fucking groupie. So there's that. You know, I'm realising how much work it's going to be. I'm realising how hard it is going to be to get people to, not to agree, but just to pin people down is going to be fucking difficult. And I'm going to get pissed off with it, but I have to. Treat that as an exercise in patience, and you know, the whole thing's an exercise in that respect. So yeah, I've got to get back to Tower Hamlets, and you know, I've got to do 50 podcasts. Absolutely got to do 50 podcasts. After that I can decide. And more than anything, I've got to get back to Tower Hamlets thing. The thing is that I'm actually, the podcast, you know, there's all this stuff about getting on the news, new and noteworthy page, and I'm fucking on there already within like a week. And I think I had about 10, no, less than 10, probably about 8 five-star reviews, which I encourage people to post. And, you know, it's amazing, but I don't, it hasn't really translated into subscribers yet. And I'm going to just try and keep up the momentum. I'm not going to let it fucking slide. I want to try and get 35 star reviews up there. And then, you know, then I'll stop hassling people. I barely even know 30 people, but if I can get 20, you know, I can stay on the new and noteworthy. And then at some point, fucking people will hopefully start to notice. If I can get subscribers, you know, who knows? Maybe I can have enough interest to attract advertisers. But aside from all that shit, I've got to find some kind of fucking job, and I've got to get back to shooting the Tower Hamlets thing. You know, I'm just wandering about down the fucking canal right now. It's a beautiful fucking day, thank god. I'm starting to feel less depressed, but I might as well be in Tower Hamlets shooting pictures. as doing this.
Oh my god. Okay. No, but that did happen.
That's classic. I mean, you know, The sun will always come out and shine on us. But that is a perfect segue, because that my next question before you played that one was going to be, you know, well, you've done 100 podcasts now. You've stuck at it. You've been doing it, and in that time, you have produced. I'm looking at it now, the proof of your book, Indicative Only, on Tower Hamlets.
Yeah.
It happened.
I mean, you know, it's still happening.
Tell us about this project, because I'm looking at it and I think it's, you know, it's really interesting. So why don't you introduce the project now that you actually...
Well, yes, the thing to which I was endlessly referring in that little clip, it's just this thing I've been doing in London for some time. Actually, I had been doing it for a couple of years before I recorded that, but kind of dipping in and out of it. But basically, it's a portrait of a London borough for my listeners in Kansas City. Hey, Jace. Yeah, it's about this particular place. You know, in a way, it's a typical borough. It's very sort of, it's ethnically diverse and it's multicultural and it's kind of very busy and bustling and constantly changing. But it's the poorest borough in London. And in the midst of it is this huge kind of office and shopping development called Canary Wharf, which, you know, is kind of a symbol of wealth and affluence, I suppose. You know, it's the kind of second financial hub of London after the City of London itself, or the Square Mile, as they call it. And there are lots of massive big banks and international financial institutions that are based there. And so the kind of symbol of this place kind of rising out of the kind of surrounding, you know, horror of kind of, you know, urban deprivation and poverty, which is, you know, rife everywhere. It just seemed like a powerful kind of metaphor for me, really. And funnily enough, it came out of, I had a title in my head for years, which was A Tale of Two Cities. It was like a title in search of a project. And I thought, what I'll do is I'll go to the poorest borough in London and I'll go to the richest borough in London. And I'll shoot in one and I'll shoot in the other and I'll have a project whereby I compare and contrast, you know, the oldest story in the book, the haves and the have-nots. And then I think it might have been George, actually, George Giorgio said, you don't even have to do that. You can find that, you know, discrepancy in one borough. I don't know if he said Tower Hamlets specifically, but it became apparent that actually that was totally true, that I didn't need to do that. It was a brilliant thought that I could do it all in one borough and just, but without being kind of heavy-handed about it. It's not some polemic, you know, really. It's not like, oh, here's what society is like. It's the oldest story in the book in a way, but partly it's about, you know, this is what this place looks like, really. And you know, that is in there, that kind of financial and economic disparity between the both extremes. But, you know, there's a lot of, you know, it's massively kind of multicultural in the sense there's lots of different religions, and, you know, there's like East End Cockneys living cheek by jowl with, you know, the kind of Bangladeshi community, and then there's your kind of hipster Hackneyites who sort of, you know, sidestepped one borough into there, and, you know, so it's an interesting place, and that's it, really. That's about all I can say.
But you've taken it, you know, you've gone and photographed the borough, but you've sort of taken it one step further. So explain to the listeners, who hopefully will be able to see it on your website soon. I don't know if it's password protected still at the moment, but the title Indicative Only. So in explaining where that comes from, we'll explain it's not just a portrait of a borough, is it?
No.
And Tower Hamlets is an interesting place because Canary Wharf kind of rises up out of, you know, and could be seen for miles. And the whole place is, I think, a metaphor for what's going on in today's world, where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer.
Yeah,
so
I think so. I mean, I think that symbolism of these big kind of glass and steel skyscrapers kind of, you know, rising out of, you know, what in the 80s when the place was built was this kind of, you know, completely deserted, run down, you know, urban wasteland, really. It was the docks, you know, it was where it was an area which would have, you know, in decades gone by and back in the day would have been busy and bustling and you know, full of people and industry related to that world, which was, you know, the import and export of stuff. I don't, to be honest, know a great deal about all that, but
no, but back to the title, because when you first showed me this, I was kind of like, oh, this is nice, you know. And And I didn't actually even get what you'd done in the first place. And when I realised what... So explain to the listeners about the title and what you've done.
You're sort of not yet. I mean, the idea is not... You're not supposed to get what I've done if I've done anything. You're not supposed to get it immediately. I mean, there is supposed to be that certain amount of ambiguity about what you're looking at, which, you know, I think is what one of the joys of photography. But what emerged really quite recently in the last year or two of the project was that I had been photographing right from the almost the first day these kind of architectural renders, these computer-generated architectural renders that they make when they're showing a proposed development. You know, and they make these little CGI people and stuff, and they make this kind of mock-up of what this building or this development is going to look like when it's built, before it's built. And I found those quite interesting, and I just was photographing them without really realizing particularly why. It just seemed like there was a lot of them because there's a lot of development going on there, and it took me ages to realize that this was something that might be quite interesting, because I was looking for a kind of overriding idea, really. You know, I think when you're making a book, and, you know, I've learned so much from people I've spoken to on the podcast and from friends and people who've done books, but, you know, the idea that you have to have some kind of coherent theme or something that's going to kind of hold it all together, you know, it became sort of very much on my mind. And this thing of doing these, shooting these renders, suddenly struck me as a really interesting kind of idea or kind of a way of showing something about what was going on. You know, these kind of idealized notions of what a cool place to live is going to be like.
Yeah,
you know,
and it's that kind of like selling you utopia, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Like, it's this beautiful... kind of utopian dream, you know, with like kids playing and, you know, whatever. And basically I realized that I could weave those images into the project throughout, that maybe what I would want to do is start with the ones that were where you really don't know if I'm looking at a real thing or an image of a computer generated image, basically, because I've gone in quite tight, so I haven't shown the context around them. You know, you can't necessarily
tell. So you've seen these things like used as kind of you know, posters, billboard, you know, in front of where the development's going on, and then you've got pictures sometimes where you've got a lamppost in front of it or a person, or you've just got the thing itself.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, I mean, and you know, this is all up for discussion. I mean, you know, someone might think that, you know, the whole idea sucks and that I need to start the project again or something, you know, that, you know, if, you know,
they might do
if Mr. Steidel says, look, I will publish this, but you've got to basically throw all this away and start again, I'll go, yeah, all right, get hard, I'll do that then. I mean, I don't know, but I remember saying to Ian Tay, you know, my bud, who's a very smart guy and a good great photographer and very, very analytical about these things and has a great way of sort of thinking about the process. And I remember saying, look, mate, I've got this idea, and if it's no good, then I've got dick, basically, after 8 years. But it's this thing about these renders, what do you think? And he said, yeah, that I actually think that could be really cool. And I was like, oh, thank God he said that, you know. Yeah, that's right. The reason it's called indicative is that what they write on these things, a bit like the serving suggestion on your packet of cereal, what they write is, you know, computer-generated image, indicative only, in case anyone might believe that they're looking at reality. And I thought, wow, that's brilliant. I've got my title right there.
I love
because
it.
Because I had, you know, The Tale of Two Cities had long since gone away. In fact, what happened was Zed Nelson was working on a kind of, no, not a similar project, was working in Hackney, the neighbouring borough, and had the same title at the same time. You know, one of those things that happens all the time is kind of, you know, creative synchronicity.
Yeah,
you know, and I remember even like at one point having a conversation with Zed, and not a conversation, like an email exchange, and I was like, look, basically, Zed, you got there first. You know, he'd already put his project out there or whatever, so, well, essentially, long story short, it's like, that's your title. And I thought, fine, you know, and anyway,
but that's led you to this. And what I kind of like about it is there's a lot, you know, we're sort of madly rushing towards AI, if you know, and how computers are kind of changing the world. And so for me, it doesn't just reference this kind of rich and poor, but it references that kind of what is humanity, what is real, what it's not.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, I like it, you know. So
thanks, babe. That's,
you've done it, and maybe there is more to do, and maybe there isn't. But
I mean, let's be on, like, you know, anyone can go and make a bloody blurb book. I mean, our mums could go and make a blurb book, you know. I mean, it's not, doesn't mean anything.
Don't demean that, because I am also editing a long,
I know you are,
you know,
and I want
project
to hear
that's been
about
going
it.
On for years.
But what I'm
into
saying is
a dummy book form, and that is something to be proud of. And now you've got something that you can tout
well,
around.
I don't
and
know if
see.
It's something to be proud of. I think it's really nice if you've been working on something for a long time to bloody make a physical dummy.
Exactly.
And be at that stage where you go, right, there's a mark in the sand, I've done enough to have 60 pictures in this book. Maybe ultimately I'll end up with a book that's got 30 different pictures in it, or the 30 pictures I haven't even shot yet, or whatever. But it's a good place to start. And I do want to sort of get feedback on it. And I think you have to put your, you know, head above the parapet at some point and go, look, give me your worst, tell me how much I suck, I don't care, this is what I have.
It's not about that though, is it? And like, I mean, there's a lot of photography books out there, and we make them. Why do we do our projects? We do them because we feel a kind of compulsion to, because we're interested in something, and because we know we're onto something. So maybe you need to go and do a brain dump, like you did about the podcast about this book.
I'll tell you what I do want to say, which is really important, that I've been really inspired by, again, you know, talking to people on the podcast, but people like Mark Neville, who is all about kind of taking the work back to the community that he shot it in, and sort of engaging or letting the people who are actually in the pictures, you know, engage with the work and all that. And I realized at some point that was really appropriate thing for me to try and do with this project. So although I've made a book dummy just because for me, obviously, you know, like all photographers, I'd love ultimately to make a book, what I want to do more importantly, I think, is to try and have an exhibition there in the borough where the, you know, the people who this is book is about, or this project is about, can you know, engage with the work. And you know, I don't know whether that's going to happen. Hopefully it will. How great would it be to have an exhibition in its Canary Wharf?
I was,
you know,
just going to say,
I mean, it would be
Canary
awesome
Wharf,
because
it?
You know, I mean, I'm not, I mean, I don't think the people, those people aren't, you know, people who work for massive banks or those institutions themselves, you know, they're not idiots. They know that they're not going to be thought of as the good guys, you know, in society. And, you know, I think they're self-aware, and that's why they have these corporate social responsibility departments, you know, and they do have projects, and, you know, that are trying to put things back into the community. But how interesting would it be to bring those two worlds together in some way? And so, you know, it has occurred to me that there might be a possibility of doing that. Or maybe, you know, if I have an exhibition in Canary Wharf, you know, maybe I can somehow raise some modest amount of cash for the, you know, for the food bank or whatever, because that's the sort of, you know, charities that exist in those boroughs. You know, I mean, there is grinding fucking poverty, and yet the average annual salary of the people who work there is 60 grand. Now, how can those two things be simultaneously true? Because of Canary Wharf. That's why. It's a weird thing. So I'd like to have an exhibition and try and, you know, maybe build a website where people can go and kind of, you know, make comments or engage with it in some way or whatever. And the other thing I want to do is print a newspaper and then hand that out. Like, make 1,000 newspapers and hand 500 out in Canary Wharf and hand 500 out in Chris Street Market or whatever. And know that both populations, as it were, have seen the same thing. Not that anyone cares, of course. I mean, you know, like I said this, you know, I mentioned this idea to someone else who, again, who's sort of, shall I name him? It's Matt Stewart. It doesn't matter. And Matt's the sort of person who doesn't mince his words, you know, but in a really good way. And I said, look, I'm going to do this thing with a newspaper. And he's like, yeah, who? What, so what? Who fucking cares? You know what I mean? And I think he was being genuinely helpful, because it is important to ask those questions, because otherwise we end up jerking off, you know. And it's like, I don't want to do that, which is why, in a way, you know, this book thing is a little masturbatory, isn't it? You know, we want this for ourselves, really, you know. And you know, as Martin Osborne said, you know, on the remotest Japanese paper with no writing on the cover, you know, it's all a bit wanky, isn't it? Let's face it, this kind of fetish for photo books, and I get that, because I like it too. But at the same time, who cares if then seven photographers and a couple, you know, and Martin Parr are gonna buy the book? If Martin bought it, I'd be very happy, actually, even if only seven other people bought it. But the point is, you know, should it be seen in a wider context, or should it be seen by people who wouldn't normally see a photo book? I think it should be, but an exhibition would tick that box in a way.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, that's the kind of thing the Arts Council like, isn't it?
So yeah, I mean, I hope that
that's the next step for you.
That definitely is going to be the next step. I am going to apply to them, and hopefully they will like that. And if they do, then I'll have the funds to do it, and that would be really interesting. And then maybe ultimately the book will come later. But what I have at the moment is simply a sort of idea for a book, really. But thank you for liking it.
Well, I know what an idea for a book looks like, and I know what, like, whole, you know, more stages down the process looks like, and I think you're more there, so
thanks, mate. That's good to know. I think it will be really interesting to show it to people. Like, I'm going to Montana in March to do the, you know, charcoal book club.
I wish I'd applied for that.
Yeah, I'm looking
an idiot
forward to
for
it
not applying for
but
that.
I mean, there's gonna be some amazing people there, and I tell you something, I'm fully intending to exploit my position,
absolutely,
you know, as the official media partner and the Small Voice podcast person, to, you know, to show stuff to these people. I mean, that's the other amazing thing about this podcast. I mean, the people I've met, you know, it's incredible. And I do sort of, and I sort of create these sort of friendships in my head that, and I'm now mates with Chris Killip and all these other people. But you know, I you get to realise that they're just people, and that I guess what I'm trying to say is that I wouldn't hesitate to ask for, you know, people's opinions, who, you know, people who I respect and whose opinions I respect. The problem is then you end up with 10 different opinions and you don't really know what.
No, but even getting to the stage where you can then go and ask people, that's another stage in the process for us photographers, isn't it? It's like, you know, 3 years ago you were sat there going, just get your... Get myself back to Tower Hamlets.
Right.
I've got to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
I've got to do 50 podcasts, and here you are, like a few years later, you've got a book dummy. You're on podcast number 100, and it's kind of that's
I've got
what
more than 35 star reviews on iTunes.
Exactly, yeah. And it's about those baby steps and just kind of keep on pushing. So
no, definitely, and
so
and
that's
I think
what's coming up for you,
you know,
then
the podcast is. Yes, the podcast has in no small way been responsible for my, you know, kind of continuing to work on this project, because I was someone who never finished anything. You know, that was one of my problems. You know, I was one of those people who just couldn't.
That's a quote that really stood out to me. Was it David Allen Harvey on your podcast?
Yes.
Was saying, you know, lots of people can take pictures, lots of people can start a project, but finishing it, that's the hard bit.
Yeah. Yeah, basically that, you know, he comes across
really
a lot of young photographers, and the only kind of difference between the ones who make it and the ones who don't is that the ones who make it have the capacity to finish what they've started. Yeah.
And that is
because,
so hard, isn't it? We both know, but you're getting now. So.
Well, I've been doing this for a long time, and you know, anyone can go out and take a few, you know, wander about taking snaps. I mean, especially if it takes you bloody years to do it. Yeah, I hope it will sort of turn into something. I would love to have a book, but I'm going to take this to Montana and show it to some people and see what they say, and maybe I'll get some constructive feedback that will change, you know, everything about what I then think I need to do. I mean, at the moment my question is, do I need to keep shooting, and if I do, what am I supposed to be shooting? Because I'm a bit over just wandering about in Canary Wharf going, well, I'm going to probably shoot myself or throw myself into that water feature because I don't know what I'm supposed to be, you know. So what I'm saying is a slightly more targeted approach would perhaps be the way forward. Now I'm at that stage where I'm like, okay, you know, if you need more, you need to know what kind of more rather than just something, you know. Like you said, do I need to show, you know, life behind these facades? You know, maybe I need to show some intimate kind of domestic scenes, you know, some particular families. I thought very carefully about what you said with that, and it's the one thing that really has kind of stuck in
my
head.
This is a conversation me and you had a few months ago when I first had a look at the project, but then looking at it now, it's, you know, I think you do, we all get to that stage where we need that a bit of a outside, but
definitely.
Unless you do the kind of hard graft to get to that point, then
you have to get to a certain point. Yeah. It's like Martin Parr said, and I keep referencing this, but you know, you can't whack this wisdom, which is, you know, like you know, like I think I asked him, you know, where do people kind of go wrong or whatever, and he's like, people are lazy, you know, like you got to put the spade work in, man. There's no way around it, you know. Don't be fucking lazy, like, you know, the projects and the books which have involved some blood, sweat and tears and some time and a real commitment, you know, they're the ones that you can see that it shows, you know, it shows. And I really take that to heart, you know, so we'll see.
So, I mean, I just think it's once again, you know, photography has taken someone from the depths of cynicism and depression into a good place where the sun is shining. I mean, that's what I love about photography.
Yeah.
And everyone I meet in the business or, you know, who has anything to do with it, really, you know, that comes across.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I guess it could be other creative endeavour. I'm miserable unless I'm making something, you know, I think. And that thing about avoiding that pitfall of becoming kind of toxic, you know, because you're a sort of deeply frustrated human being. And I think, you know, I honestly think that's why it just suddenly occurred to me recently that, you know, the reason there's so many unhappy, miserable people in the world is that I've got a theory that these are creative people who, for whatever reason, bought into some narrative back in the day that they're not creative. I'm talking about, you know, accountants and dentists and estate agents and, you know, whatever. And in their soul, that they're, you know, because they somehow at some point decided they weren't creative, they're not making anything or producing anything. And that's one of the reasons why there's so many miserable people in the world. That's my current theory, basically. Donald Trump, for instance, is probably creatively, although he's got so many other issues that he's not a good example.
Someone should probably
have just held his head underwater as an infant. But it occurs to me that there is a redemption in making something. I'm really excited about the idea of starting a new project.
I'm really stoked about
the idea of just going, you know, okay, I'm not, obviously this, there's a lot of work to be done. This is the thing one has to remember, you know, once you've finished a project, then that's when the work starts, because you then got to get it into the world, and there's a lot of hassle, you know, in doing that and work, and it's, you got to be as committed to that happening as you were to doing the work. But it would be really nice to just then go start shooting something else.
Have you got anything in mind, or are you?
No, absolutely not nothing. Nothing whatsoever.
Something will come.
Yeah, hopefully.
Something will come. So before we finish up, what's on the horizon?
Well, all of the aforementioned, really. I mean, trying to bring this to fruition to a point where it's actually a finished project one way or another, whatever that means, whether that's an exhibition or a book or whatever. Ultimately, hopefully, it will be both. And God alone knows whether that's a realistic prospect, but there I go. But yeah, you know, bringing that to fruition, keep podcasting, obviously, keep doing a small voice, because I love it, and
we love it so much.
I love you, Abby, for,
yeah, and you know, number one fan.
You know, it bears repeating that I didn't know 3.5 years ago, I didn't know anyone. I was really on the outside, and this goes back to the other question of why I do it, or why I decided to do it. I was very, you know, I felt like there was this little world, you know, of you know, kind of photo land in London where everyone knew each other, and which turned out to be entirely true. There is, but I was not in it. That was for damn sure. And I was like, I've been doing this for 20 years, and I don't know anyone. Am I that unsociable? Am I that kind of miserable? Actually, yes, not unsociable. You know, and people don't want you around if you're like that kind of person. And now, like, I didn't know you or, you know, millions of people. And now, certainly, I know people and have genuine friendships that I didn't have there. And that is the absolute nicest thing in my life, you know, that I've got that. And that was just from, you know, saying to people, come and have a chat for an hour, I've got a podcast. You know, like, there'd be very little reason for me to phoning up a complete stranger and asking if they'd have a chat with me without these microphones, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's that thing, isn't it? It's that amazing thing how doing something creative takes you on a whole new journey. And that's why you've got to feel the fear and do it anyway, like you said. That's
Yeah, and you
kind
know,
of motto.
Never believe you played your last hand. You know, just never believe you played your last hand. there's always more cards coming, you know.
So, listeners, Ben will be back doing the interview next week. But thanks for
I knew you were going to be the right person to do this. Thank you so much. Bless you for doing it. I hope that wasn't too narcissistic. I don't know. But the listeners will decide.
Yeah, the listeners will always decide.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye.